In Utah, nearly 1 in 7 people experience food insecurity. Food insecurity basically means a person often is uncertain about where or when he or she can get nutritional or safe food day to day. And what's more, in Utah alone, 1 in 5 children are unsure where their next meal will come from. These figures are startling. Meanwhile, here's another seemingly unrelated problem. The fruits and vegetables most of us buy in grocery stores will travel from far away for hundreds of miles, delivered on trucks burning fossil fuels. Yet, if you look around in many of our urban neighborhoods, you'll see plenty of fruit trees in the summer and fall months dropping and wasting perfectly good food. Well, in Salt Lake City a few years ago, Sean Peterson saw a potential entrepreneurial solution to these seemingly insurmountable problems.
And one of the things we have done is we've taken this bus and converted it into a mobile greenhouse. And we do that so that kids will get excited. You know, young kids, they're familiar with the school bus. It's something they know a lot about. And so when they get the chance to come inside it, they're like, whoa, this is a greenhouse? Oh, can I come in? And they come in, they eat things. They eat things they wouldn't eat normally. They go, oh, I don't like cucumbers. But, oh, you're growing cucumbers in the bus? I'll eat a cucumber. And our goal is that they take that home to their parents and they can help their parents make a healthy food choice.
Sean has done more than turn an old school bus into a mobile greenhouse. He's been building a community network of innovation to make the most of existing resources of food already growing in our community to not only fight hunger, but also to strengthen communities. Recently, Doug Wells sat down with Sean Peterson, who is the executive director of Green Urban Lunchbox, a Salt Lake City-based nonprofit focused on reducing food insecurity and getting people excited about growing food locally.
Sean, welcome to The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me.
So if you would start off telling our audience a little bit more about what Green Urban Lunchbox does.
So we do a ton of different things, all in the urban agriculture space. Our ultimate goal is to fight hunger and to find ways to bring communities together. So we run 4 main programs. One is our fruit share program, where we go out and harvest people's unused fruit trees. The second is our back farms program. In this program, we put gardens in low-income seniors' backyards and then pair them with a young garden apprentice who wants to learn how to organic garden. And then we run a farmer training program. It's an incubator program for farmers who are looking to start small businesses in agriculture. And then we do some food distribution via some free farmers markets at local senior centers and a low-cost mobile market in the Glendale neighborhood. So
that's a very ambitious set of programs. How big is your team?
We're a really small team. In the summer, I'll have about 14 people working combination of part-time, full-time, seasonal type positions. But in the winter, there's 3 of us who are year-round full-time, and then I have a couple AmeriCorps Vistas that work in my office as well. So.
Okay. And how did you get started in this area?
By accident, to be honest. My background's in the restaurant industry. I've done a bunch of artisan food businesses at farmers markets and small catering company. But I had a brick and mortar restaurant down in Utah County that went belly up in a big way and found myself bankrupt and kind of lost and confused. Like, what am I going to do next? Realized I hated the restaurant business.
It's a tough business.
It's really long hours. And it just wasn't that rewarding. You know, it's one thing to make people the best pizza or something else that I've ever eaten, but it just, the amount of work and effort that went into it wasn't as fulfilling as I had wanted it to be. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. I took a few years off and did a bunch of traveling that kind of shaped my worldview. And when I came back, I wanted to do something creative. And I didn't think this is what I'll do. But I just wanted a creative project. So, I took and converted this 35-foot school bus into this mobile greenhouse. And it was a way for me still to be connected with food because I just become more and more concerned about where my food came from and what I ate and how that made me feel and how that affected the world around me. And because of that, I said, you know, all right, let's do something creative in the food space. I still really love food. I love, you know, making really good food. I love that. Let's do something on the agriculture side. And so we converted that 35-foot school bus into this greenhouse. And then once it was done, I was like, oh, what am I going to do with this thing? You know, all this effort and work has gone into it. And everything we do kind of evolved from that. You know, once we had that bus, we were like, okay, what can we do with this? And I had like this grandiose vision that I would drive it around to some farmers markets and community events, and I'd get people really excited about growing food and inspire them to grow something on their balcony or in their front yard. And then I maybe can make it pay for itself by, you know, helping people connect people with CSAs or other organizations that were going on in the community. And that quickly didn't work.
Well, I'm sure you did inspire people.
Inspiring definitely still happens and still worked. But like, as far as what I quickly found out is that there was a lot of need in the community and there wasn't other organizations doing those things that I could connect them with. People would say, oh, could you do this? Or do you know someone who does this? And I'd be like, yeah, I'll find someone. And then I wouldn't find anyone. And then our besides the bus, our earliest programs are Back Farms program, where we put the gardens in seniors' yards. And that happened because I kept running into seniors who would say, I have this huge space in my yard. Could you find me someone to garden it? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, I'll find you someone. And then this one woman was just super persistent. She'd call me like, you know, every 2 or 3 days, did you find someone? Her name was Fran. And I just said, I'll do it. And I went over and started gardening for her. And so, you know, that from there, I had like an amazing experience and it spawned this whole program that is a super powerful program of connecting people across different generations and using this space. And
I like you because it works on several levels, right? I mean, the whole idea of gardening and it's my understanding, I'm not a gardener, but it's one of America's most popular hobbies. But you do need land, you do need space. And so young folks that have the energy and maybe the time to take care of a garden, they don't have the land. And then people that are seniors have the land, but, you know, maybe they don't have the energy that they used to have. And so it works on that front. But as you said, it also works on this connecting. Now the elderly in our community have a connection with young people that's beyond just, hi, how's your day?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I love about it, is it's that multifaceted programming.
So let's go back to the school bus.
Yeah, sorry.
It sounds like that's fine. It sounds like that's where this started. So you were running a restaurant, tough business that didn't work out. You decided to take some time off and travel. What was it during the travels that helped you get some clarity that when you come back, being in the food space in this non-traditional way was something that you wanted to pursue?
So I've always had this lifelong goal. I want to learn to sail. And so I bought a boat on eBay, moved to Southern California, spent 9 months learning to sail, and then with a couple of friends sailed across the South Pacific. And in the South Pacific, I had this chance to see a ton of really diverse communities. I spent some time in the Marquesas, which has this really intact culture where their food culture is really still connected. They eat a lot of traditional foods. They grow a lot of food. The people seem super healthy. And then I had a chance to visit some countries with a less intact food culture, I guess. One of those was Tonga. And when I was in Tonga, what I saw was Tonga's become like this dumping ground for food that the rest of the world doesn't want, you know, like really weird canned products and just really processed food. And I visited some parts of Tonga that still have a connection to their food culture, but the difference between those two parts was so stark. And it just really started me thinking about the role that food plays in our community. You know, it's what we say in our office, you know, is everyone eats. And that everyone connects in some way around food. And And what we eat says so much about us and what we value. You know, if all we eat is junk food that's super convenient, but not healthy and not good for our planet, then that says that we don't value our health. We don't value the environmental impact of our food. What we value is our time. And we maybe don't even value that connection of sitting down
and money. Right? Yeah. Because oftentimes these processed foods are less expensive.
Sure.
Yeah. We have these big corporate farms. They're very efficient to raise. Mm-hmm. They use chemicals that aren't healthy for the planet. They get shipped a long distance. In fact, I want to talk about that being shipped a long distance because that's a common theme in the educational materials that you have. One of the stats that you share is on average, we as a nation are spending 10 calories worth of fuel in order to get 1 calorie into the mouths of the consumer. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's that unsustainable relationship that we have with how our food's grown. You're right, like we grow it in these really efficient farms. And those farms are only really efficient as long as we have a really cheap energy source that we can expend like that. And as long as we don't count those environmental impacts, you know, as long as we don't worry about where those pesticides and fertilizers run off. This has not always been the case here for us or for the world. This is a really recent development where we're using so much synthetic fertilizer. You know, that's the real environmental impact of food, is the way it's grown. You know, those synthetic fertilizers that we're using are incredibly damaging to our soil health and our environmental health. And it's a limited resource. At some point, we're going to have to figure out how not to use oil products to fertilize crops.
Well, and so part of that is there are these efficient farms, but they tend to be far away.
Yeah.
Right? My grandfather was a farmer. He died before I was born, so I never knew him. So this is all from my parents. But he raised my mother and her two sisters, so a family of five, on a farm with 11 acres. And I actually did some research. Back when my grandfather came over before World War II, he saw what was happening in Europe. And so he was kind of a refugee. He saw what was happening, yeah, and he wanted to get away from there. Came to the United States. And back then, one farmer could efficiently farm 25 acres.
Yeah.
And his farm was 11 acres. So, you know, he could have used more land, but he couldn't afford it. Fast forward to today, and it's one farmer can efficiently farm 125 acres because of all these, you know, the tractors, the automation, but also the chemicals. And they predict in the next 7 to 10 years, that's going to go to 250 acres. So there's a lot of good that's come from that.
Sure. Yeah.
But there's also some bad. And part of one of the things that was startling to me is not just the impact of the chemicals, because we're hearing about that, and there is the movement for the organic, but just the energy cost to get food from point A to point B.
Yeah.
Does it have to be that way? Do we have enough food locally that we could provide most of our needs?
Oh, no, not even close. We grow about 9% of the vegetables that we eat in Utah. We do really good on dairy.
But we grow a lot of the alfalfa that
we do.
The cows throughout the country eat.
We do very good, actually, on, you know, growing enough dairy or enough meat or anything like that. But our fruits and vegetables consumption, comparatively to what we grow, is so low.
That's Sean Peterson, the founder and executive director of Green Urban Lunchbox, speaking recently with Doug Wells. You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. Today we're talking with Sean Peterson, who a few years ago converted an old school bus into a mobile greenhouse. Peterson created a nonprofit, Green Urban Lunchbox, to originally educate children at school about the importance of growing food locally and eating healthy. But he says doing this proved to be very difficult to staff and to pay for. The bus greenhouse has become mostly a cool marketing tool, but since then, Peterson says helping urban fruit tree owners to harvest and share their fruit has become their biggest and most self-sustaining program.
So how the program works is if you had a fruit tree in your yard that you weren't harvesting, say it's an apricot tree, you would go online and register that tree with our program. And then we offer a bunch of services that we charge people for but are at a discount. Like if you wanted the tree pruned or if you didn't want to be the one that picked up the 100 pounds of apricots that fell on the ground afterwards, or if you wanted the tree fertilized or anything like that, we offer those services. But we harvest the trees for free. So you'll get an email when it's time for your tree to be harvested, and we'll come out and harvest that tree. And then we take in everything that's grocery store quality. Well, so the produce gets split three ways. It's harvested by volunteers. They can take up to a third. The homeowner can keep a third. And then we get at least a third. In reality, we end up with about 60% of the fruit because most people can't eat 150 pounds of apricots. And so we then, all the grocery store quality produce, we donate. And then anything that's damaged or, you know, just doesn't look quite right, we make it into a value-added product. Well, we partner with people to make it into a value-added product. Originally, we thought we would do that, but it didn't really work very well for us. So we have partnerships with, like, Mountain West Hard Cider, where they make a hard cider that's branded under our name, and we get a third of the proceeds back to fund our organization. Partnerships with Bitters Lab that makes an apricot bitter and an apple bitter. Several restaurants like the Bagel Project, the Rose Establishment, make a product with our produce, and it's branded so people learn about our organization, but it also helps raise funding and awareness about what we do.
Now, how did that idea come to, if you'll pardon the pun, fruition?
So we knew we had this damaged produce, and we weren't really sure what to do with it. And I thought, oh, we'll make jams or we'll make jellies. And we tried some chutneys and all sorts of other stuff. What we quickly found out is that we're not jam makers. That's a lot of time and energy goes into making those products. The margins are pretty small. Margins in alcohol tend to be way better, apparently. And so
alcohol businesses are thriving.
They are
here in Utah. You know, actually, we need to have a couple of those entrepreneurs on as guests as well.
You guys should have those guys out. Like, several great people doing some cool stuff. So yeah, we started looking for other partners. And I was driving and heard an ad for Mountain West Hard Cider. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I went over there and just talked to the guys and said, hey, would you be interested in doing a product? And we, in our partnerships, every program we do, we look for this win-win situation. We don't feel like anyone has to lose. And so like with Mountain West, their traditional ciders have, I might be wrong on this, but I think it's 4 to 5 different varieties of apples in it. The cider that we are able to provide them with the juice for has about 20 different varieties of apples in it. So it gives them a really unique product. It's got this
and a good
complex
story.
Flavor,
good.
And it's a fun, great story. It's a great partnership for them, and it's a great partnership for us. You know, they'll take thousands of pounds of these B-grade and damaged apples that, you know, our chickens can only eat so many of them. You know, we don't have a use for them. It's just
that's
great.
I think that's a very clever solution. And actually, as I hear you talk, there's a lot of clever solutions here. You know, part of it is that you perceived a door opening, like for the hard cider. You heard an ad, you heard them on the radio, and you decided to pursue it. What do you think it is in your background? There's a lot of people that wouldn't take that initiative. What do you think it is in your background that made you comfortable putting yourself out there and asking?
You know, I have this strong belief that you can do just about anything if you want to do it. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, I can't do that, or I don't know how to do that. You know, we live in this age with so much information available. If you want to learn how to do something, you can basically learn how to do almost anything for free. You know, sure, you can't learn to do heart surgery or brain surgery for free, but most things that we want to do, we can learn for free. And I had never sailed when I decided this is what I wanted to do. And that was an incredibly powerful experience for me to learn that, yeah, I can watch some YouTube videos, I can read books, and I can cross an ocean in a motorless boat, right? And if you can learn to do that, like, everything else seems kind of small to figure out how to do.
That's a great. I'm glad you brought me back to that, because that does show the tenacity and the power of putting your mind to something. You didn't buy the sailboat and sail off to the South Pacific. You know, we probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. You spent 6 months in Southern California making sure you learned everything that you had to learn.
Yeah, you can't just go out and do anything the first try. You have to learn those skills, but those skills can be learned if you want to. Right.
On this topic, so you had that experience at the restaurant that went bankrupt. I mean, that's a devastating personal situation for a lot of folks. Did that beat you down? How hard was it to get up off the ground from that?
That was really tough. You know, I had spent years building this business, and really thought that's what I would do. And I mean, I was very young, at an age when, you know, you think you know everything. And I mean, when that happened, you know, I was living in this little Nissan pickup truck that the repo guy would call me every day to ask me where it was, if he could have it back. And I'd be like, no, you can't have it because I'm living in it. Give me a few weeks. I got to figure some things out. And, you know, I had a lot of resources available to me. And being able to use those resources, you know, I realized very privileged to have those type of resources available to me. And not everyone has, you know, like a strong family background and connections. And I was able to find work very quickly. But, you know, it's really tough to think you know what's happening in your life and then realize that it's all fallen apart. And then to think, what do I really want, and how do I get back there? I believe that everything can be broken down into really small parts. And if you break things down into really small parts, they seem manageable. You know, if we go back to sailing, to learn how to raise a sail is much more manageable than thinking about crossing an ocean. Or learning how to read a chart is it's like, okay, I can learn how to read a chart. You know, for me, it was today I can find a job. You know, today I can save enough money to give this car to the repo guy. And breaking things down to those small parts, in the Green Urban Lunchbox, today we can find someone who wants these, you know, 30 pounds of plums or 80 pounds of plums, and then building on those parts.
Thank you for sharing that. I mean, this is a deeply personal part of your journey. I love that breaking it down into small parts, because some of the most daunting tasks, sailing across the South Pacific, I would include in that, can be broken down in small tasks. And there's an entrepreneur most of our listeners have heard of, Elon Musk, started Tesla, and he uses the term first principle. He breaks things down to first principles, and that's how he ultimately was able to figure out how to introduce to America an electric car. And his vision was never to be a car manufacturer. He wanted to break America's and the world's dependency on oil for transportation. So that concept is so powerful, at all levels in our life. Yeah. And the other thing I want to share is none of us escape without major setbacks in our lives. And sometimes the longer you go, you know, it's not unusual early in life. You go to school, you succeed at school, you go to college, you succeed at college, maybe you get a graduate degree, then you start a business, and maybe that's the first time that you've experienced how hard it can be to make things happen. It's no longer a task. Your job is to make the impossible happen.
Yeah, and the bigger things we try to make happen, the harder they are, right? And the more setbacks we're going to experience. You know, you think about Elon Musk, I'm sure he experiences some incredible setbacks. You know,
he almost went bankrupt.
Yeah.
I mean, here's one of the wealthiest guys in the world, and he was months away from going bankrupt and, you know, during the financial crisis, because the auto industry got crushed by that as well.
Yeah.
And it's what you do during that. I want to go back to the fruit sharing program.
Yeah.
And then get back to some of the other programs that you guys are doing. One of the things in the fruit sharing program is you were able to partner with Salt Lake's Division of Sustainability.
Yeah.
First off, I didn't know Salt Lake had a Division of Sustainability, so I'm glad to hear they do. What do they do, and how were they able to help?
So they founded the fruit share program. They had seen some similar programs in other states and said, you know, so they actually brought us on. They said, hey, we hear you're doing this thing in people's backyards. Would you like to do some other thing in people's backyards? And I said, sure, let me come in and let's at least look at it. And our partnership with them has been really beneficial in a couple of ways. They provide a lot of legitimacy for us. It's not some random guy, some hippie driving around a school bus asking you if you can come pick fruit in your backyard, but it's, you know, the city talking about this program. I think we've added a lot to that program because we were able to really bring these entrepreneurial sides to it. Like, how does this program fund itself? How do we improve the health of the trees without having to find a ton of grant money? And so... That was a great part of that partnership. They do a ton of great things over at that in that department. So,
your organization recently bought a farm in Layton. Tell us.
So we didn't buy a farm in Layton. We lease a farm in Layton from UDOT. It's an old orchard, has about 400 fruit trees on it. That we go out and harvest each year. And we originally, so we've been leasing that land for about 4 years now. And we originally ran a farmer training program on that piece of land. But we've moved that farmer training program down here to South Salt Lake now. We have 3 acres that we lease from the county over there by the jail off of 33rd South.
And, you know, mentioning the jail, I don't know, but I've heard that the jail also has a farm associated with it that the inmates work at. Are you involved in that?
No, we're not involved in that, but we partner with that. We do these free farmers markets at senior centers, and we partner with the jail's horticulture program to do some of those markets. They host one every week, and we host several others. And then we also partner with them because we send these fresh produce baskets with Meals on Wheels recipients every week. And they help provide a lot of the produce for that. So, okay.
So you guys have a lot of programs going on. You're running a lean staff. As you look at the future, what are some things that you're hoping to do in the future that maybe you're not doing today?
You know, our big focus right now is internally raised revenue. How do we move away from the grant-funded model, and how do we become more self-sufficient? So like our farmer training program, farmers pay a tuition to enter the program, but it doesn't come close to covering costs. So this next year, we're launching a CSA, which is this community-supported agriculture. It's where people buy a subscription to get a weekly amount of produce. And that's one of the ways we're trying to fund that program. You know, long-term, I'd like to see us as an organization with, you know, 70 to 80% of our funding covered via funds that we raise internally. So we're only raising that small portion through grants. It allows us to be more flexible, allows us to do experiments and fail. Grant funders don't tend to like to fund something if you can't tell them it works. And I like to try things that might not work. So
And it's best to use money that you've raised yourself or created by value creation yourself, as opposed to asking donors to do. Are most of your donations and grants from private organization, or do you get some federal and state funding as well?
We get a little bit of federal and state funding, but most of it comes from private foundations.
Okay. And if people are interested in finding out more, they want to learn how to be a farmer, they have a fruit tree that they'd like harvested, maybe they're elderly and they'd like to offer land for somebody to garden, how do they get in a hold of your group?
They jump on our website at thegreenurbanlunchbox.com, or just Google the Green Urban Lunchbox will come up. There's all sorts of information on there. You can sign up for just about anything you want to do. You can get on our volunteer newsletter. You can buy a CSA share. You can register your tree.
Okay. Well, it sounds like a great organization. Sean, thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me out. It was great.
Sean Peterson is the executive director of Green Urban Lunchbox, a Salt Lake City-based nonprofit focused on reducing food insecurity and getting people excited about growing food locally. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and edited and produced by me. You can catch this entire conversation again on our website or the podcast version for this show. I'm Ross Chambliss. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.